hormones relevant to women's health, they're just hard to measure there. So the goal is to be able to measure 4 hormones once per hour for 7 days. And if we could do that, I think it would be transformational. Hormones are kind of like the operating system of the body. They play a role in our immune system, bone health, mental health, and reproductive health, how our genes express themselves. They are just extremely influential, and especially in women, because women have a more complex hormonal system than men do because of how biology has created us.
Thank you for listening to Sprint, the podcast of the Federal Agency for Breakthrough Innovation of Germany. I am Thomas Ramge, and I'm very much looking forward to our guest today, Ida Tin. Ida is the mother of the term femtech, and she's also the founder of one of the most successful European digital startups improving women's health. Most of them will know it, Clue. And Ida is also a new colleague of mine here at Sprint. Ida has joined our agency as the lead of a big new challenge we have launched on hormone monitoring. We'll have this conversation in English, as Ida is a Danish national. My Danish has become a little bit rusty, so we stick with English. Anyways, mange tak for being here, Ida.
Selv tak. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, that's as far as it goes, I'm afraid. So we talk a lot about the hormone challenge in the latter part of this conversation, but let's start with your biography, which is obviously quite unconventional, quite unusual, as might be the very first question. So what is your current relationship status with motorcycles?
So I still love motorcycles. I don't have one right now, and I haven't had one for a while. And especially when spring comes, I feel this tingling. For me, it's such a sign of spring when the first motorcycles come out. I think I'm getting ready to have one again, I think, after having small kids and kind of no time and no place to really ride them.
I'm sure you'll drive very carefully anyways, but to give our listeners some context, you sort of have grown up on motorcycles. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is fair to say. My parents were, or they are, really adventurous and decided to go travel with their 2 small kids through South America when I was 1 year old. So I sat in front of my mom on her motorcycle, and my 4-year old brother sat in front of my dad on his motorcycle. And then we traveled I think we did 4 long tours throughout my childhood. And then I've done a lot of motorcycling since then in different ways. So I grew up traveling on motorcycle. I was also home in between, so it wasn't all the time. But it was my parents' livelihood to write books and give lectures about our travels. So it was definitely a big part of my childhood.
And not only your childhood, that is also fair to say, I would assume, because, this has obviously very much influenced your further career. Take us a few steps further. At some point, you've been sort of motorcycling professionally.
Yeah, that's true.
Put it that way as well,
so,
right?
Yeah, I did my first trip when I was 18. I had lived in London, I had earned some money, and I thought, okay, you know, what would I love to do? And I was like, I want to go motorcycle traveling. So I did that with my boyfriend at the time. We bought 2 small motorcycles. Motorcycles were a bit more expensive than we had anticipated in Mexico. So we got 2 small, kind of shitty Taiwanese motorcycles. But nevertheless, we traveled on them for 6 months, and it was great. And then I later went to a very creative kind of business school called the Chaos Pilots. And it's a 3-year program. And on the second year, you had to do an internship somewhere in the world. And somehow I ended up traveling through the Atacama Desert with a schoolmate on motorcycle. And the school thought that that was ridiculous. But it turned out that it was actually the perfect internship for me, because I then later started a motorcycle touring company with my dad. And we actually did a tour through the Atacama Desert. And in many ways, that was the perfect training for what I did. And then I had moved to Copenhagen after I graduated, And at some point I had this thought, what if I made my life radically simple? What if I didn't have a place to live? I didn't have friends around me. I didn't have any belongings. And I thought, what if I could just sort of have my motorcycle and me and the desert? What would happen? So I went to these sort of desert parts of the US with a motorcycle and a satellite device and had planned to do that for 7 months and then ended up doing it for 2 years because it was so much fun.
But it was not only fun. You only made money with it, right?
Yeah. So it was a mix of running the motorcycle touring agency with my dad. So I would fly out and do tours in Mongolia or Vietnam or other places and then go back to my sort of solitary desert motorcycle life. It was a really great experience in many ways. Yeah, I learned a bunch. And at some point I realized that if I were not to do that forever, it was time to go home because it was kind of addictive. You know, when you never know where you're going to spend the night, what's going to happen, who you're going to meet, where you want to go. You're always very sort of in the present and kind of alert and you meet lots of people and it's sort of intense. So quite addictive. Went back to Copenhagen, kind of forced myself to buy a flat and and stay there.
Well, you didn't obviously not end up in a 9-to-5 job as a state employee of the country of Denmark, but rather became an entrepreneur. How did this, on the one hand, unconventional upbringing, plus this very early, very intense kind of entrepreneurial life, did prepare you for becoming a digital startup entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think it was several parts. I'd seen my parents being able to create a livelihood out of what they loved doing. So I had this belief that you could kind of follow your dreams and somehow make it work. I came home from the US trip and wrote a book about that and kind of followed my parents' steps and gave lectures. So I think I had sort of the belief that you can follow your kind of ideas of what is really meaningful to you and that will somehow provide a livelihood. I had also gone to the Chaos Pilot, as I mentioned, which was a very kind of radical school in believing that you can change the game and that you can be kind of a force for good in whatever area you try to engage with. So at some point I had this kind of insight that there had been so little innovation in family planning methods. And that kind of blew my mind because I was like, that's one of the most foundational questions for human mankind. Like, how many people are we going to be on this planet? And how do every person control their childbearing, which is like, you know, some of the biggest decisions we make in life. And when I realized that there'd been very little innovation, it kind of pissed me off, honestly. I was like, how have we not cared about this? And I thought, I want to make sort of some sort of dent in that history of family planning. And that was 2008 and the smartphone had just come out. I didn't have one. But I thought that's a really intimate and kind of great place for this kind of information. So I had the idea for Clue. I basically wanted to build a piece of hardware. But there was no tech ecosystem.
Monitoring cyclists in a more precise way, yes, in order to improve family planning for...
Yeah, because I thought, instead of taking hormones, what if we could just monitor them and know exactly where we were in our cycles? I mean, a woman can only get pregnant about 6 days per cycle. So why would you have to take hormones every day as opposed to kind of having data guide you? Yeah, so it's almost 20 years ago. Tried to build that thing for 4 years together with the Fraunhofer Institute. Did not succeed, probably for a number of reasons. So it's kind of full circle that I've come back to this theme now, so many years later, but in a new and I think better way through Sprint. But it's not that I didn't want to have a job somewhere. That's not why I didn't work at some public institution in Denmark. It's just that I always had these kind of strong ideas of something that I really wanted to do. And then I was kind of naive or crazy enough or willing to be poor enough to get them going somehow.
I mean, your motorcycle world, I've read that, has been quite male dominated. How did that sort of shape your idea of how to improve things in obviously what you've considered or what has been or still is a sort of underserved market?
Yeah, so I grew up learning to ride a motorcycle when I was, you know, really young. I think I was 11 my parents were building a house for 2 years. I was always part of building the house using power tools. And I think I was just brought up in a very kind of non-girly way. And my brother was sort of my, you know, my closest person as I grew up. I, you know, always hung out with him and his friends when we got older and went partying way too young, you know, did all these things. So I think I was very non-typical sort of girl universe. And my mother, she's also a very strong adventurous and a woman. She's not, she's probably also done a bunch of things that maybe you wouldn't expect a woman to do. She's traveled a lot alone in the Middle East and many other things. I guess I've always been somewhat comfortable being sort of in men-dominated realms, which the tech world definitely also is in many ways. Maybe I'm also more masculine than maybe my appearance kind of reveal. I think I'm, you know, I think I'm quite quite the man in some ways. I'm also definitely quite the woman in many ways, but I'm...
You know, what does that mean?
What does that mean? I think there are some of the kind of gender attributes that some women maybe take on because they're kind of taught, which is like maybe being a little bit helpless or a little bit sort of, I don't know if I can do that, or like, oh, I wouldn't like to not, you know, I don't, you know, wouldn't like to sleep in a tent, or, you know, I don't, sort of princess kind of behavior type things, which I don't have so much of, I think. I'm also very stubborn and kind of opinionated and ready to put my nose out and kind of take a fight if I need to, even though I don't like that at all. But I think it's a really weird dynamic when you raise capital, which I did a lot for the startup and together with my ex-partner, who's a man. But I learned that there's often something about sitting across the table with this typical man investor, male investor. And it's almost like he doesn't really hear what you're saying. But the second you say, you know what, I disagree with you, and kind of show up with a little bit of like confrontation, they'll be like, oh, okay. And it's like, then they come online. So I think I learned that kind of ability to push a little bit also in a relation and sort of some characters that I think you expect more from a man were sometimes needed to sort of be heard, really.
Can you turn this disadvantage even in an advantage?
I mean, I think what you get when you're a woman in a male-dominated industry is that you get attention. You can surprise people because they really don't think that you can ride a motorcycle, and it turns out you're pretty good at it, and they're like, oh wow, she's actually like good at it. I don't like it. It's not my natural thing to kind of show off or to like, you know, I think men do a lot of this kind of tutorial sort of, you know, this is how much money I raised, or this is the name dropping I can do, or this is what I've achieved, or I got this award, or like, you know, I've been in so many rooms with like bro tech people where this goes on, and I can do it if I have to. And often it's like, I cannot be bothered. But if you have to like kind of command the room for whatever reason, you do all this bullshit and it works. But it's like, so I can switch it on if I need to, but this is not my natural, maybe feminine kind of self. And I don't like it. I find it ridiculous, really. But
boy, it can get so boring, can't it? Even for a man like me.
It
gets so boring.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Boring.
I guess it's not a coincidence that your expertise and your the field you've been founding it and you've been as successful in has been women's health and not whatever other kind of, or not any other kind of interesting field where medicine could need innovation. Why that? Why has it then in the end come back to femtech?
I think as a founder, at least for me, the most important thing where it all starts is like, do you really care? Like, do you deeply care about what you're trying to do? Because it's so hard and you have to tell people about it over and over and over, and you have to inspire other people to care about it, and you have to have conviction. So it's, women's health has a special place in my heart, I think, which is probably related to having traveled the world since a kid. I've seen women's lives all over. I feel very deeply the sort of the strength of women and their pain. And also, I think I'm also kind of a pretty sort of kind of logical and rational thinking person. This is maybe also more of my sort of masculine traits, but I look at it and I'm like, it makes no freaking sense that we don't invest more in this. It, like, financially, like, in all kind of ways, like, this is dumb. Like, come on, guys, like, what are we doing? So, I mean, I have that kind of sort of fire, I guess, of like, we can do better. We should, we could, we must do better. Maybe also because I feel I can do something, you know, it's a space where I'm like, yes, we could do this and we could do that and we could do this.
But it almost sounds like there's no dose of feminism in the term femtech, as if that it's a pure coincidence. And I suppose it's not.
It's not feminist tech, it's femtech. And the idea with that was simply to create a term that would take all this activity that was happening in the tech world and say, look, when you put all these activities together, it's a sector in itself, and it's helpful to perceive it as a sector for people who are trying to orient themselves, for the people in that field so they can find each other. And it was also a pragmatic kind of tool because of all this gender kind of divide and stigma and weirdness around it, it was difficult for male investors to kind of present to their partnerships on Monday partner meetings, like, I'm looking at this case and it's, you know, it's trying to make women not pee their pants. It's just like, that's a hard thing to do for anybody. But for a man in front of a bunch of other men, it's much easier to say, I'm looking at a femtech opportunity here. You know, so it's like, I wanted to create a language that could bridge.
I understand. In terms of storytelling, the term is much closer to fintech than to feminism, yeah. Right?
So honestly, I was sitting thinking, like, what could we call this? And I was thinking femtech would be like the most natural. Like, exactly. We know fintech, we know, you know, edutech, all this. And I asked my team at Clue, like, hey, I have this idea. We need a term. Like, what will you call it? And somebody said, well, femtech. I'm like, yeah, duh. Like, that's like it doesn't have to be smart. Like, it just have to be simple. So.
Yeah. So even an investor, a male investor on a full doses of steroids might be understand that there is a big market out there if 50% of the humanity is female. And this is a completely overlooked field in the medical sense, but also in the sense of a market.
Fast forward 10 years, it's still somewhat overlooked. A lot is happening, but I don't know, this is a little bit of tangent, so stop me if you don't think it's relevant. I was just in LA for a big conference called the Milken Global Conference, which is probably the biggest gathering of capital under management, trillions of dollars. Like, anybody who's anything in the financial world is there, and all the family offices and the endowment foundations of universities. Like, there is so much capital there. The Middle East capital, like, there is huge amount of capital. And they did a session on women's health, and it was in the cellar. It was small, and all the men in suits were not there. It's so interesting because I had this kind of observation looking at this for 3 days, where my sense was that these people are so deeply disconnected to a sense of being part of a planet and an ecosystem. And they have no sense. I mean, this is a huge generalization, but there is no sense of every time we talk about growth and making money and making a profit, we are talking about extracting something out of the planet, doing something with it and gaining everything for ourselves. When you think about women's health as a societal infrastructure, as a business opportunity, as something that we do because it will make humanity healthier, it will make women engage, which creates a more balanced society, which leads to a more balanced ecosystem on the planet. Like, that whole line of thought is so foreign for a lot of the people who have the money and the power to actually care about this. It's just not on their radar still. It's getting there, but there is a huge blind spot. It's phenomenal. It's staggering to observe.
Do you have any explanation?
So I'm so happy that Sprint is doing this challenge, because that's like such a, it's like, yes, you know, we need these projects and signals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we need the tech, obviously.
I guess we always try to be a piece of the puzzle in the big jigsaw. But do you have an explanation why this blind spot is so persistent? Despite the fact that women like you have been successful, have proven that there's a huge market, have proven that technology can improve women's health, especially because it has been a neglected field and so forth. Do you have any explanation for it?
I think there are a number of reasons. I think it's complex. Also, I should distinguish, there is the thing of like when you invest in female founders, they return capital better, they're more cash efficient, and mixed teams perform better. Like that's well established, that's a fact. So there is something about women in the tech world, that's its own thing. And then there's women's health, which can be made by women or men. So two different things. I think we generally have a huge problem bridging genders so that the life experiences that women with female biology have just not transport over to men very well. And that is partially because women don't share enough about their stories. They say they have a headache when in fact they have period cramps. They don't tell what it was like to have a late abortion or to miscarriage or all that. There is so much going on our life journeys, so much. And everybody has a story. So how do we learn to tell these stories and how do we create enough safety that we can share them? And how do men get enough safety that they can tell their stories about women's health? Because most men have a story too about some women they're close to. So I think that's like the basic, like we just, if you don't know, how are you going to care? And then beyond that, there is a lot of like kind of market dynamics in the healthcare system. You know, if you as a society save something, you know, you spend some money to save money, that saving, where does that get registered as sort of a win? And I guess we also haven't kind of put, we're not good enough yet at putting a price tag on what it costs when women are not well, right? McKinsey came out with a report in 2024, said it costs the world $1 trillion every year that women don't get adequate healthcare. We know that when women drop out of the workforce too soon, it's extremely expensive for society. So we're starting to kind of see glimpses, but women, they endure a lot of pain and discomfort throughout their life. We know that, right? They spend 25% more of their year of their life in poor health, but they kind of push through. They go to work even though they're miserable. They take care of families and double care burdens even though they're also working full careers. Like, so we don't have a good way of seeing how expensive that is. I think it's super complex. And then, yeah, we left women out of clinical trials because we didn't know how to deal with this fluctuation that created mess in the data when we're trying to understand, does this drug work? But it's fascinating because as soon as, like, if you have a lens where you start seeing things through this gender perspective, like gender-informed medicine, or actually looking at numbers and investing accordingly, you start doing things differently. But you need the data, you need the awareness, and you need to kind of care. How do you make people care? I think that's the big question.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's complex. And
you also came up with not only some ideas on how you make people care, but how men can better invest into femtech, right? So what?
Yes.
Okay, let's step a few steps down in the ladder of abstraction. So to get it more concrete, well, how can especially men with deep pockets justify in the boardroom that they want to invest in femtech?
Sometimes people think that when you go pitch to a VC, it's a business conversation. I think a social dance is a much better term for it. It's a really weird kind of the VC trying to figure out, like, do I trust you? Can I, like, do I think that you can make my money grow? Do I think you can be a strong leader? Do I think you're ambitious? Do I think you're smart? Like, you know, there's like this set of ideas of what it'll take to be a successful founder. And I don't think that the pattern recognition works very well across genders. I think sometimes that leader will look very different from what is expected. So I think there's something in like making that match happen. And I fully recognize that is very difficult on the man side as well. Here you are sitting with somebody that looks totally different, talks a different language, doesn't have the markers that you would usually look for, trying to convey a need in a space that you can never feel in your own body. You don't know much about it. It's uncomfortable. Your job is to say no every time, except a few exceptions. So I wrote a guide. It's just 7 pages, which is an honest, like open heart attempt to tell men how to do that meeting better. How do they actually get what they need, which is to really understand the business idea, the person, the kind of the need. And it's a very human exercise. Like, how do we create enough safety in that room on both sides so they can both kind of shine and actually meet? And also a little bit like, dude, do your homework. right? You would not go into a conversation with somebody doing crypto and have done zero homework. Like, you know, literally, you know, that person shows up and like, okay, what's a computer? Like, no, we cannot start at what's a computer. That's too far. And I feel I have educated VCs over and over and over and over. And I hear that from every female founder in FemTech. They have to start at Adam and Eve. And that's not fair. And then on top of that, you have a whole system that is, in my opinion, deeply sick. There are some power balances that are awfully off and they're being fully exploited. It's a system where wealth get more and more concentrated, which I think is a problem on our planet. There's all kinds of things kind of wrong with the venture model as it is, and there is very little accountability. So that's like a whole set of problems that comes on top, and they kind of hurt women a little bit more for a number of reasons. So what you do your homework, you show up truly humble enough to actually know that there is something that you don't know. And your task as a VC is to figure out, what does this person across the table know that I don't know?
Well, and on the other hand, it's all so obvious in that context.
Yes, it's fucking obvious.
It's just so, it's so banal that it's so banal that it's even hard to believe that the men in the room don't know that they don't know the same stuff about the female body as most women do. I mean, that's so
You would think so. But you know, when I had the idea for this hormone sensor back in 2008, I was like, I better be fast because surely the big diagnostics, they must be building this, right? There were like these kind of little computers where you would pee on something. And I was like, you just need to like, why does this thing only remember 3 months worth of data? What if you connect it to the phone? Like it was, and you could have this replaceable. That's a great business model. I was like, this is so obvious. I better be fast. Nothing happened. They didn't fucking build it. For 15 years, I've been asking people, why then? What happened? And the answer I get back is so banal that I can almost not fathom it. But it's very often, it's just like, yeah, but the people who are making these decisions, they're like 55 white men. It's just not, they don't feel the pain. They don't know how desperate we need these products.
Okay.
I'm like, can that really be true? That is such a lame answer. But I think it's true.
I get
somehow
that.
A part of it.
Okay, get that. I get how difficult it is, but there are a lot of rich women out there as well. Why don't they invest in femtech neither?
They do more and more. And it's really exciting because there's, I'm sure you've heard this, like the biggest transfer of wealth ever in the history of mankind, because the baby boomers are now so old, so the men are dying a little bit before. So these wealth pools are being transferred to women. So it's the biggest transfer of wealth to women ever. And it's huge. And I think that is going to change how, you know, family offices give mandates, how angels invest. But also don't underestimate that social stigma is also true for women. If you are a woman and you say, I really want to do something about breastfeeding, it's not as sexy as I'm going to invest into, I don't know, autonomous parcel delivery or something. It's like you still have to somehow like take a little more of a stance if you do anything in women's health. It's my experience.
What are the most important clues from your clue story? So from you being a successful founder?
Well, first of all, I really want to say it is such a group effort to do anything. I know it's easy to see me, but you have to imagine a huge group of people that build Clue, including my co-founders. I think one insight I'd like to pass on to people maybe thinking about starting a company is that start with a really big idea. Start with something really hard because it will attract other people because they want to be part of building meaningful, important things. And it is, I think it is as hard building a startup if your idea is small. So go for something hard.
Hard and meaningful? Okay, lesson one.
Hard and meaningful. Something that the planet really needs.
Okay, find the right people. Or you attract them by being, by aiming high.
I think so.
So what's lesson two then?
Lesson two is that I feel that there is a little bit a thing going on where it's considered like kind of like a fancy career choice to start a company. I just want to say it is extraordinarily unglamorous as well and really, really hard. and it's not for everybody. I think you have to be born with some sort of extreme tolerance for uncertainty and insecurity. I think it's helpful as a founder if you have a great willingness to do sort of your inner work and grow as a human, because there's a very big correlation between how you grow as a founder and how the company grows. And so kind of having the openness or ability to look quite deep in yourself and kind of meet your fears is important and needed. And also because you have to handle a lot of fear in yourself, on your team, your investors. To do that, you have to somehow first deal with your own fear continuously every day. It, founders doesn't have to be for everybody. Oh my gosh. Like, let's not make like some sort of, you know, that's like the new cool thing to do. Only do it if you have to.
And you only have to if you have the big mission and you can't help it, obviously.
Yeah.
And on the tactical, I mean, this was always very deep and very, very profound on a psychological level and even almost on a moral level. How about on the tactical level? I mean, you've led this company to success about 14 years, I think. Now then you transferred to the board. What are your most important tactical lessons? How you made a big but crazy idea succeed on the market?
Find people who are better than you and smarter than you and hire them and give away as much as you can to the people who are best at stuff. In the beginning, you do everything because you have to. And then you gradually have to be more and more an expert in whatever field to be more professional. You really have to kind of bow down and give away stuff and realize that other people will be better at it than you. I mean, honestly, all the way to the end, where at some point I realized that to be the best leader I could be for Clue, I would have to keep learning. I mean, you learn new things every day. Oh my gosh, I felt I had a new job every day. But I was like, oh, the things I will have to learn in the next year. I wasn't passionate about learning to get better at Excel sheets, frankly. I don't say that sort of diminishingly. I have a lot of respect for really good operators. But I felt like, oh, other people could do this better now than me. And so I hired two new CEOs and they were better than me in many ways. I will also say, on the other hand, when I had been away from the company a few years, I also realized that founders do bring something that is really hard to replace, which is the why are we doing this and where could we go? So, yeah.
Well, at least now you've been transferred into another mode where your mission is still the same. Right.
Yes. So fantastic.
It's still all about hormones. That
it's
crazy
so
pattern that the female body is producing, and where we finally have to make sense of, right?
Exactly. And I love that I could go from building one company to really think about how do we build an industry. I love that. I think that's like my super sweet spot. Let's see how it all goes. It might all go to hell. I hope not. You know, maybe I'll fail spectacularly. But I really love the sort of the big strokes kind of design work. I think that's where I'm best. And I find it so kind of lucky in a way that I can now use what I've built the last 15, 20 years and kind of show up with enough credibility that so many people have said, yes, this sounds so interesting. I'd love to be part of this. That's what a gift that is.
Well, I mean, clear answer to the why. Now we get to the how and what. The how.
Well, luckily, Sprint has a lot of experience.
Okay, so you're not done with your startup, but I mean, you're sort of not operative in it anymore. But you have founded an association called Femtech Assembly.
Yeah.
What do you do there? What's the approach there? And how, in the end, Sprint chimes in here?
So after I left Clue as CEO, I kind of decided that I just was going to say no to everything for some amount of time. And it ended up being 2 years. And then I sort of got curious about my inbox again. And I just kept getting invitations to talk at all kind of conferences and places all over the world. And I thought, okay. So I did that and I met kind of the femtech ecosystem all over the planet. But I found myself in really different settings. So anything from like, you know, hey, I'm thinking about starting a startup, to people in the European Investment Bank, in the UN, and funds of funds and VCs, all kind of different people. And I realized that I was doing the kind of sort of ecosystem work that you would do in a think tank. And I was like, we just need the world to understand that if you invest into women's health, you make money and you make the planet healthier. There is a direct line. It's such a simple investment thesis. Why is this not being adopted by angels, institutional funds, funds of funds, governments? It's like, it's that simple. So I started the think tank. And then I realized that, well, actually, think tanks, they usually are busy with building their own organization, raising money, writing reports that not enough people read. And I was like, I don't want any of that. Actually, what I want is to enable all the, I meet so many brilliant, brilliant people with long careers, and they say, I really want to do something in women's health. But how? Where do I start? And I'm like, I just want to be some. So then I thought, well, actually, what I really want to do is more of like a social movement. So I thought, little starter kit, like some sort of name that people can take, put on themselves, some sort of badge, and they can do things, they can organize, they can start things, they can, you know, it's just like give them this little first like spark that makes them go, okay, now I can do something in women's health. And then Sprint happened. And then my think tank kind of stood still.
So what honestly, happened? So Sprint happened. What does that sentence mean in your context?
So life took a super weird turns, and I got a call from one of our colleagues, and we sort of chatted for 40 minutes. I didn't really know why we were chatting, but that's not unusual because I often get approached to people who want to have a conversation about what they're doing. So it's like, okay, let's have a conversation. And then 40 minutes in, he's like, well, we're looking for an investment manager. I was like, okay, well, I'm not really looking for a job, but I had a second conversation with another colleague, and then they got back and they're like, Ida, you have said women's health and femtech like 100 times. Maybe we'd rather try and make something where you only have to worry about innovation in women's health. I was like, okay, this conversation is getting more interesting. And they said, we have this form we call a challenge. And I spoke to a head of challenges, Jano. And they said, like, well, what would you do in women's health? And I said, the data set that's really missing in women's health is data on hormones. And I didn't say that because I failed building my sensor 20 years ago. I said that because I have now worked in women's health data for all this time, and it really is a data set that's missing. And he said, well, okay, why don't you try and go and scope this challenge? So I did. And Sprint said, okay, let's do the challenge. And I said, okay, let me do the challenge with you guys. So here we are. So that's how it's been. It's amazing.
We're glad you're heading it. So give us the story in the nutshell. What is this hormone challenge now about? What are the aims? What's the context? What's the scope?
It's trying to create some technology, some biosensor that can give us continuous hormone monitoring. And continuous is really the key word here, because we can take a blood sample or do a saliva test or something and get a value out on hormones. But the problem with that is that we only get these snapshot pictures of what hormones are doing. And hormones, they create curves, and they're very time bound. They are rhythmical, and you really want to understand the raises and the falls, and also how they interact. And we don't have technology on this planet yet that can do this. We have a continuous glucose monitor we can put in our arms, and it'll give you data for 2 weeks or a bit longer. We don't have that yet. People are trying, but it's just super difficult. Hormones, and especially the ones that are most relevant to women's health, they're just hard to measure there.
Why?
Fickle. They fold on themselves. They do weird things. They are in extremely low concentrations. So the goal is to be able to measure 4 hormones once per hour for 7 days. And if we could do that, I really think it would be transformational. Because it happens so that hormones are kind of like the operating system of the body. They play a role in our immune system, in our bone health, in our brain health, in cardiovascular health, in mental health, in reproductive health, how our genes express themselves. They are just extremely influential, and especially in women, because women have a more complex hormonal system than men do because of how biology has created us. And it's been so fascinating talking to people about this, because many different people say that would be a very interesting data stream to have, whether it's people in oncology, in neurological diseases, in assisted reproductive health. So sort of on the clinical and kind of industry side, people are like, this is a very relevant data set. You could also imagine that it can be part of building a foundational AI model on women's health, something we don't have today. You can imagine it being part of drug discovery. And also, and I think this is what kind of touches my heart, is that I have literally not met a single woman I've stood in front who didn't say, I'd like to understand my hormones better. Like, we have this kind of intuition that, yeah, we know that hormones really affect us, right? We have mood swings, we have bleeding, we have, you know, going through a pregnancy with this crazy hormone shift. Like, we I think almost every woman has this kind of experience, lived experience of hormones playing a big role. But we have no insight into them, like none whatsoever. Complete black box. We like, and even if you could do a hormone test, it's like you get some value. The norm ranges are so enormous that they're meaningless. And what does it really tell you? Nothing.
Obviously, makes all sense. How hard will it be to get this biosensor with this continuous ability to monitor?
I am hopeful, and I think the timing is really good. I'm like, wow, I was kind of crazy to try this 15 years ago or 20 years ago. I think now is really good because people are trying, but they're underfunded. They're working extremely isolated. So that was another big insight doing this preparation work for the challenge, is that there is no ecosystem. There is no industry. And to do something as complex as this, we really need to bring people together. Because once is like, even when we have the technology, then we need to make sense of the data. We need to understand how does these hormones affect all these different disease areas? And then how do we change protocols out in hospitals? How do we educate users to understand this data? So it's a really complex system. I'm building an industry network as well around the innovators. And we are building also a shared data pool and reference data, which is kind of a foundational piece to be able to do further research. So your question, like, will we have this technology? Well, my strategy will be to choose teams from lots of different technology directions, because people are trying many different things. And I don't think we know yet which one will work. And I'm pretty sure that without this level of public funding, it would still take many years till we get there. Both because, you know, building each gadget is difficult, but we need an industry to then adopt this technology. So I think a lot about how do we build an industry on top of this data set, and how do we make it global? So I've been trying to raise a twin challenge in the US as well, to be able to include US teams. Let's see if I'll be successful or not, but I'm definitely going to find creative ways to bring some of that talent into the ecosystem. Even if I can't fund them, I know they want to be part of it, to really create the sort of oomph that we need to get going.
They can partner with European teams. Hey. Let's catch some talent. Let's catch some talent from overseas. has been going on a long time the other way around. So that's
another perspective for me on this challenge, is that, you know, this question of what will Europe live from? How are we going to stay competitive? I think it's a unique moment to bring this industry to Europe. We have the manufacturing capability. We have the know-how. We have funding. Let's make this the epicenter of this new thing. I think it's going to be a huge industry. I think it's going to be much bigger than the continuous glucose monitors, which is already huge. So, and we have the best data regulation, which is also really needed because this is sensitive data and you need to build trust with users. We can do that better in Europe than anywhere else. So I'm like, come on, let's anchor this here.
We need some tech sisters in contrast to tech bros, I guess.
Some tech sisters. Well, sometimes people say, you know, build by women for women, but I say build by diverse teams for the world. We need to work together on this. There's no way we can do this as one gender alone. And why would we? It's more fun working together anyway.
Sure. Give us a few details on the technicalities. When are the teams starting? How long do they have time in order to make their proposals and so forth?
Yes, so the challenge is opening on May 11th, which is today,
the day we are recording.
It's still on, that's for sure. And it will be open till, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I know the exact date. About 6 weeks, it'll be open. The jury will get together on 9th and 10th of July to meet the teams or select the teams and set then the final eight teams. There'll be eight teams participating who will get full funding. The first year they get full funding. Then there is a deselect. So two teams go out after the first year and then another two teams after the second year. So it'll end up with being four teams that get up to €6 million each. And they will get mentors. They'll get the industry network. And then there will also be five tickets for what we call rising stars. So this is extraordinary young sensor technology talent that is outside Europe. And they can get microgrants to keep them in the industry and to infuse our network with some of the best talent out there, which maybe is also a hiring pipeline for the teams. And then there will be five tickets for what we call global front runners. So these are extraordinary scientists from around the world relevant to this challenge, who we cannot fund, but we can give them a flight ticket and a night in a hotel in Berlin so they can come. And everybody's going to meet twice per year in Berlin, or at least in Europe. Let's see exactly where, because we need people to start working together. Otherwise, this will not happen. It's so complex. You need to figure out, like, what's my regulatory path for this? How am I going to fund this? What's my business model? Who's going to buy this? We need to start building all these partnerships and relations from the beginning.
Interesting. Obviously, dear listeners, you'll all find all details on our Sprint website in the challenge section. Ida, give us an optimistic outlook. Let's say 5 to 10 years from now, your biosensors work. We have a much better knowledge about continuous hormones in the female body. What will have changed?
I think in 5 years, we will start having things that work. They might not work perfectly and all the time, but we will start getting solid data. And I think in 10 years, we will have it embedded in consumer wearables. You know, your Oura Ring will have continuous hormone monitoring, both for men and women. At that point, I think lots of men would like to follow the testosterone levels and see if their workout makes a difference, etc. I think before that, we will have it used in clinical settings. So I think IVF clinics will use it. I think we will see lots of research around this to understand why does patients with Parkinson's have different symptoms as that correlates with their hormones, what was actually happening in the body, why is this connected? I think there'll be so many research questions, and I think it will lead to better care, better preventive care, and lots of savings and lots of money being made, but most of all, improved lives.
Yeah, well, we should be reminded that the future is very likely better than the present, so often we forget that. Last question, and I ask that one to all of my guests, as you might know. What kind of radical innovation, breakthrough innovation, Sprung Innovation do you wish for in the year 2050, which has nothing to do with hormones?
It has to be something in climate. I really would love us to not mess up the climate entirely. I hope that in 50 years, we are way past fossil fuels and we will have learned to do fusion and lots of other interesting new energy sources. I'd love to see breakthrough innovation in energy creation, storage, transportation, / climate technologies.
CO2 extraction, maybe. We'll need a lot of energy for that.
Yes. Yes, but I would love us not to do too much symptom fixing, but rather fix the root causes, but it might be a little bit of
I guess that's a question of timing. At some point, you'll need to extract it anyways. So
yeah,
to get it to not to pre-industrial levels, but to bearable levels.
I'd also like to caution that I think some of the technology fix ideas we have, I think, are really bad, and I'm kind of I think technology will be a big part of solving our climate crisis, but I'm also a little bit concerned about us deploying really bad ideas technologically. So I hope we will be wise.
I sense there's no fan of solar geoengineering here in the room. Anyways, thank you, Laurita, for this very, very interesting tour d'horizon on how to improve women's health and how continuous hormone observation is or measuring is a very important part of it. Thank you a lot.
Thank you for having me. I hope women's health would prove to be everybody's health, planetary health in the end.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you to all of you, dear listeners. If you like this podcast, we would be very grateful if you could leave us a rating or even a short review in your podcast app. This episode has been produced by Max Zollner. Thank you, Max, as always. The next episode will drop in 2 weeks from now. Until then, as always, please stay curious.